Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, Saving Brinton, a new documentary, tells the story of how Michael Zoss saved a historic collection of slides and films from being lost forever. I'll talk with Zoss and filmmaker Andrew Sherburn. But first, another important piece of history, the Iowa Constitution. Iowa has had three constitutional conventions in its history, one in 1844, another in 1846, and the third in 1857. All of those conventions took place in Iowa City, Iowa's former capital. My guest, Todd Pettis, is a constitutional scholar and professor in the University of Iowa College of Law. He holds the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation, and his book, The Iowa State Constitution, will be published by Oxford University Press next month. He'll be sharing some of his knowledge about the Iowa Constitution and its origins in the building it was drafted in, the old capitol in Iowa City, tomorrow evening from 7 to 8:30. Todd, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Charity. I'm really happy to be here with you.
Now, Iowa became a state in 1846, but that first constitutional convention took place in 1844, right?
In 1844, that's right. The first real kind of settlement, if you will, white settlement, was in Burlington, and we were the territory of Iowa then, which covered today's Iowa and Minnesota, the Dakotas. They set up in Burlington, and the governor, Robert Lucas, who was chosen by President Van Buren to come lead this new territory, he started thinking about statehood pretty quickly and the need for a constitution. He was a very combative, very determined man. He used to be the governor of Ohio and had kind of led Ohio in this battle with Michigan about where their proper border was, and he was very proud of his role as commander-in-chief. He really thought about statehood and conquering territories and claiming a lot of land for oneself. That's kind of how he was wired. And so he and others had ambitions for statehood, and it led to the founding of Iowa City to serve as a capital. Robert Lucas set that process in motion. And in 1844, they finally held a constitutional convention. They had asked Iowans several times for permission to hold a convention, and Iowans had said no because the government at that time was paid for by the United States government. The salaries of all the governor and elected officials were paid with federal funds, and people weren't eager to take on the tax burden of statehood.
But being a territorial government was cheaper than being a state government.
It was much cheaper. It had some downsides. All of your legislation could be voided by Congress. The president got to choose who the governor was, but again, it didn't cost you anything. And so the salaries were paid, and you got an annual allowance, if you will, an annual budget that came from the federal government. But finally, they decided in 1844 to hold the first constitutional convention. And that's right, they held it what is now Old Capitol. It used to be the Capitol.
And that first constitutional convention, who was in on that? Like, who would be deciding? Who would be writing the first constitution for the state of Iowa?
In those days, there were two political parties, the Democrats and the Whigs. And we use that word Democrats now. It meant something very different then. So just think of it as a different party, if you will, and the Whigs. But they were pioneers, of course. One of the main things that they were worried about, and it sounds very dry to our ears today, but they were dealing with the problem that they didn't have any national currency. And so when you're trying to buy things, sell things, no one in the country had a ready source of currency. No dollars. And so there are all kinds of competing currencies issued by separate banks. But Iowa did not have – it had one bank called the Miners Bank of Dubuque, which had been here from the beginning of our territorial days. But that bank was poorly run. And so most of the paper money that was in circulation – in the territory at that time, was issued by banks that were far away. And you had no idea how much it was worth, because all this piece of paper in your hands told you was that if you go and present it at that bank, that the bank is obliged to pay you in gold or silver. But, you know, promises are promises. You don't know if you actually show up, will there be anybody there? Have they shut down? Do they call some of these wildcat banks, because they would set themselves up in places where only wildcats would roam? And so there's a lot of economic uncertainty. That was one of the driving issues. There were issues of race that were starting to be on their minds.
So in 1844, of course, slavery was legal in the United States.
Slavery was legal in the United States, but not in Iowa under the Missouri Compromise of 1820. You kind of draw a line along the southern border of Missouri, and all the land north and west of that, which would include Iowa, was free territory. But I think one thing mistake we make sometimes is we kind of draw a real sharp night and day line. There's the slave states, you know, where things are horrible, and then there's the non-slave states, which are, by our sensibilities, very progressive and doing all the right things on race. And that's absolutely not true. One of the very first things that the territory of Iowa's lawmakers did when they set up shop here was pass a law making it illegal for blacks to come into the territory unless they were carrying with them a certificate issued by a judge attesting that they were free. And they also had to put down a $500 bond. $500 is a lot of money then. I haven't done the math, but thousands and thousands of dollars today. A $500 bond that they would sacrifice if they were convicted of any kind of a crime while they were in the territory. One of the things that they debated at the 1844 convention was whether they ought to put something in the Constitution that would tell blacks altogether that they were not allowed in the state. And they took an initial vote on that during the convention, and it passed. And so the convention that was the Constitution that was slated to come out would have had a provision in it saying that if you're of African descent, you're not allowed to come into the state at all. By a vote of, I think, 35 to 32 or something, very close, they ultimately rejected that, not because necessarily of that the right sensibilities prevailed, but they thought that, oh, if we put this provision in, there's reasons given a particular clause in the United States Constitution to think that if our Constitution has this provision in it, and when we go to Congress and give them the Constitution that we've approved and ask to become a state, that they'll turn us down. So we better not do this. Iowans still did that as a legislative matter. A representative named Billy Hahn, not long after this convention, introduced legislation making it a crime for blacks to come into the state, and that was on the books for about 13 years until they finally repealed it.
One of the other important things that they had to do in deciding statehood and in writing this constitution was also decide what the borders of the state would be.
Yeah, what shape it's going to be. And again, remember Robert Lucas, this very kind of territorially ambitious man. One of the things that he did in 1839, soon immediately upon becoming governor of Iowa, is he's leading Iowa in a battle, a bloodless battle, but still a very tense battle with Missouri to our south about exactly where the boundary is. It's called sometimes the Honey War. Mm-hmm. So he was very much involved in that. But when they first started thinking about statehood, he proposed some boundaries, and they were pretty ambitious boundaries. And so if you kind of picture the shape of Iowa in your mind today, with the southern border about where it is today, the west and the east borders about where it is today, but he wanted the northern border to point upward all the way to today's St. Paul, Minnesota. So that was his pitch. There was a French explorer who came through at federal expense, kind of mapping out the upper Mississippi River territory and so forth. And when he wrote up his reports to Congress and kind of was trying to suggest some natural lines that might ultimately define state borders, he proposed some very small borders. So there's two options that are on the table. Well, this got very quickly swept up in the debate about slavery and about the North versus the South. You know, we're in the 1840s, the Civil War is coming here soon, end of 1850s and 1860s. Already great tension between the North and South. Well, when they're looking at all this territory, kind of west of the Mississippi River, and they're thinking about starting to divide it up in the states, representation in Congress was a very important thing for them to be thinking about, because when you are a state, you automatically get two senators, and you all automatically get at least one representative in the House of Representatives. Well, Northerners, in the kind of the established, from the original colonies, the original states, and then adding to that Ohio and so forth, bringing you all the way over to the Mississippi River, Northerners wanted the West, including Iowa, carved up into as many small states as possible, because this was all free territory. They didn't have the South's heritage. They didn't have this. Slavery was not embedded in the economy.
So they would stack the deck.
They would stack
anti-slavery senators and anti-slavery representatives.
Exactly.
Theoretically.
Exactly. And the South, on the other hand, wanted just the opposite. They looked all that territory, and you know, I'll parody it a little bit. You know, carve it up into two or three, you know, enormous states, and they'll each only get two senators. And so there was a long fight in Congress about that. And Stephen Douglas, who's famous of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, a representative then from Illinois, later he becomes senator, later he runs for president and falls short. But Stephen Douglas is in the House at the time. He's the chair of a very powerful committee, the Committee on Territories. And he's the one that proposed the boundaries that we ultimately have today. And so that man, Stephen Douglas, is directly responsible for Iowa's borders, especially its northern border.
And that represented something of a compromise?
It's a compromise, exactly. And so the northern border, of course, we don't go up so far as St. Paul, but it goes a little further than the Nicolet plan would. It goes a little further to the west than it would. So it's larger than what Nicolet, this French explorer I referenced, larger than what he had proposed, but smaller than what the ambitious Robert Lucas had proposed.
So we've talked about currency, we've talked about slavery and race issues and borders or boundaries. Anything else that was really contentious in that first constitutional convention?
They argued about, should we have a lieutenant governor? Should we not have a lieutenant governor? How long should the terms? We still do. How long should the terms of office be? Should judges be elected or should they be appointed by someone who's already in office? They argued about a lot of those things. But when you look at what really kind of drove them apart, banking, was really at the center of it. And it's kind of sad in a way, not deeply sad, but a little bit sad, because so much time was spent arguing about this. And when we come back to our most recent constitutional convention, 1857, banking is again the main thing that drives the state to have a new convention. And it all became a moot point because in the 1860s, the federal government decided to move toward a national currency.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Todd Pettis. He's a constitutional scholar and professor in the University of Iowa College of Law. He'll be talking about the Iowa Constitution and its origins at the Old Capitol in Iowa City tomorrow evening from 7 to 8:30. And we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking with Todd Pettis. He's a professor in the University of Iowa College of Law. He holds the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation. And his book, The Iowa State Constitution, will be published by Oxford University Press next month. Tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, he'll be sharing some of his knowledge about the Iowa Constitution and its origins at the Old Capitol in Iowa City. And we've talked a lot about that constitutional convention in 1844. And Iowa didn't become a state until 1846. We were talking earlier about that dispute over boundaries. That was really the thing that stood in the way of having that constitution accepted and Iowa becoming a state, right?
That's right. And the way, we don't have to get too caught up in the procedural details, but the bottom line is that when that constitution was actually sent out for a vote, the way it was positioned in front of voters was such that if they voted yes to ratify, they would be getting state boundaries that were smaller than what they wanted. We talked just before the break about how then Representative Stephen Douglas proposes this compromise between these two competing plans. That's something that happens in 1846, so we kind of have to fast forward a couple years to get there. But in 1844, when we kind of followed Robert Lucas's vision of a state that would extend all the way up to St. Paul, today's St. Paul, Minnesota, a lot of Iowans wanted that. And when Congress offered Iowa statehood, they said, we'll give you statehood, but you're going to have to take smaller boundaries than that. Again, because Northerners were prevailing in Congress and they were trying to carve us up into small states for anti-slavery reasons. And that went through a vote. About 13,000 people cast ballots, all white men, women not allowed to vote. Women didn't get the vote in Iowa until the 19th Amendment to the federal constitution in 1920. So all men and all white men, but 13,000 cast their ballot. And by a pretty close vote, just by some hundreds, that constitution was voted down. And so we continued on as a territory for a couple of more years. And then it was in 1846 that they decided to take one more try. So they reconvened with a new set of delegates, much smaller. They worked for much less time. They reconvened at the old Capitol in Iowa City in 1846.
And how different is that document that they came up with in 1846 than what they came up with in 1844? Are they pretty similar?
They're very similar. Sensibilities in Iowa really hadn't changed much in any significant way. It had just been a couple years prior where a very large convention, I think they had 72 men or so there working on it. And it was a typical, when you think of a constitution, it's about what you would expect, establishing the three branches of government and how you get these different jobs and what the powers of each branch are, a Bill of Rights and so forth. And when they reconvened in 1846, they said, you know, we don't need to redo really any of this. So they kept the Bill of Rights as it had been drafted before, almost verbatim. Most of the Constitution they kept verbatim. They focused their debate on a couple of things. One, they returned to this question about banks. And again, they needed currency, a source of, you know, what we think of today as the dollar bills and coins that we carry around. Where are we going to get that? And how can we trust it to have value? And should we authorize banks to do business and issue that kind of thing here because we don't have a national currency? And also back about the boundaries. What should we do about the boundaries? And there were many on the boundaries question who wanted to stick to their guns and say, we're going to be a bigger state. A man named Augustus Dodge, and we have Dodge Street here in Iowa City, Augustus Dodge was the territory of Iowa's representative to Congress, and he came under heavy political attacks after 1844 because when he came back and said, well, they're offering you statehood, but you have to be a small state, a lot of people blamed him for not negotiating more effectively. He kind of learned his political lesson. So here in 1846, he's really urging Congress to do something to get those boundaries a little bigger. And he, in his friendship with Stephen Douglas, who's a representative from Illinois, that's how we get the Douglas Compromise that gave us our boundaries today. And then they focused on banks. And on banks, they made what we would say historically to be a big mistake. What they said is that no banks of any kind are going to be allowed to do business in Iowa. And they also made it very hard, in order to kind of cement that in, they made it very hard to amend the Constitution. And that was a significant change they made from the 1844 draft. Calling a convention is a big deal. You have to really want constitutional change in order to do it, and you have to be able to sell it to the voters. And so these people who didn't want banks and a way to kind of cement in their choice in this political battle they were having in Iowa, they made those changes. No banks can do business in Iowa at all under any circumstances, and you can't say otherwise with some little constitutional amendment. We're going to have to come back here and do it all over again if you ever think you can get us to change our minds.
So is that why they did it all over again in 1857? Was it the banks?
That's absolutely why they did it all over again. It was all about the banks. But what's funny is the reason they were able to do it all over again kind of brings us back to Stephen Douglas. It brings us back to questions of race and to questions of slavery. And what happened is, during that time period, so we become a state in 1846, December of 1846. We finally have a constitution by a very close vote. Iowans approve it. So we become a state. And the state is booming. People are moving in. The soil, as everyone in Iowa knows, is even today very fertile. So a lot of people are coming in. And so even though we don't have a currency and we're very kind of hobbled by that and life is made very difficult by that, it was hard to point to any particular economic problem. You couldn't say, well, the state is falling apart. We can't attract any business here. No one productive ever wants to come here because we don't allow banks. A lot of people were flooding in notwithstanding. So they were arguing about that. And then what happened in 1854, okay, so we're 8 years into statehood, Stephen Douglas decides, and some others in Congress, but he really led the charge, he decides that we need to repeal the Missouri Compromise of 1820, that kind of very foundational law that had said that all the land north and west of Missouri's southern border was slave-free. Stephen Douglas argued that we ought to give these territories and states, including Kansas and Nebraska, which were kind of next up on deck, we ought to give them the ability to choose for themselves. Do they want to be slave states or do they not want to be slave states? And he proposed what came to be known as the Kansas-Nebraska Act.
So those first two constitutional conventions, the information that we have about those is fragmented.
Yeah, and you chose exactly the right word, because if you want to do any research in that era, there's a book called Fragments of the 1844 and 1846 Conventions, and that is our only record of what happened there. We don't have anything that purports to be a full transcription. It consists of little fragments. The 1857 convention is different. If you want to read the proceedings, it fills two very thick volumes. But those first two conventions, you have to do a lot of reading between the lines.
Well, in that 1857 convention, there are a lot of conversations taking place that aren't necessarily reflected in what was written into the Constitution, right? There's a lot going on.
There is a lot going on there. And one of the things that, you know, I teach constitutional law. I know the Dred Scott case. I read the Dred Scott. It wasn't until, and I'm embarrassed to say it, but it wasn't until I was doing the research for this book that it finally connected in my mind that Dred Scott, the case, which I can describe for you briefly, just to remind people what that case is, though most will remember, Dred Scott was pending in front of the United States Supreme Court at the same time we were having that 1857 convention. Dred Scott was argued twice in 1856, once in, I think, February 1856, and then another time over a several-day period in December of 1856. Well, it's January of 1857 that our third and final constitutional convention began. And the issue in Dred Scott was whether Mr. Dred Scott, who at one time at least had been a slave in Missouri, whether he had acquired his freedom when he was taken to nearby Rock Island, Illinois, and when he was taken to the territory of Wisconsin, both free areas. And after a long kind of tortuous proceedings in the state courts, he had filed a federal lawsuit. Federal courts are not open to just anybody. Under the federal Constitution, you have to meet one of certain specified requirements to be able to litigate, to file a lawsuit in federal court. And one avenue into federal court is to say, I'm a citizen of the United States. And so the Dred Scott court was contemplating, was Mr. Dred Scott a citizen entitled to sue in the United States for his freedom? And if he is, then we're going to have to look at his claim. Did he acquire his freedom when his owner took him voluntarily to these free areas? Well, we didn't know what the court's answer to that question was going to be. And so one of the things that they were arguing about in 1857, race and questions of race, kind of joined banking finally, and maybe even eclipsing banking a little bit, as something to talk about. Because they didn't want to write a constitution that would have within it enough racial discrimination that was going to come to turn out to be unconstitutional or impermissible as a matter
so
of federal law.
If they guessed wrong, then this document could just be useless.
Exactly. If they guessed wrong. And so there's a man named Rufus Clark, a 40-year-old, very kind of mild-mannered attorney from Mount Pleasant, who was apparently a little insufferable at times. I think he came off as a little self-righteous. Even some of his allies on the issues, it's clear in reading the documents, they didn't have a lot of fondness for him. He really kind of led the charge in terms on the cause of racial equality. But one of the arguments that Rufus Clark and others were making was, you know, when it comes to voting, serving on a jury, serving as a appearing as a witness in judicial proceedings, these kinds of public education. Should we provide public education to children of color, or should we restrict it to white children? He was making kind of a two-part argument. One part was just what we would think of today as racial justice and what does true equality demand. And another thing that he was concerned about was, again, if Dred Scott comes down, as he predicted it would, and said, Mr. Dred Scott is a citizen, he's black, he's entitled to certain things, a lot of things under federal law. We have to treat him and other blacks who come to Iowa in a particular and honorable way under federal law. We better have a state constitution that lines up with that. And then there are others who are predicting that that's not how Dred Scott's going to come out. And they also oppose that same impulse toward racial equality. The convention closed in early March of 1857. The next day, Dred Scott came down. So there's about 24 hours that separate the end of the delegates' work. They're just packing up and, you know, climbing on their horses to go home. And that's when the United States Supreme Court comes out with its ruling. And Chief Justice Roger Taney writes the opinion of the court. People may know in this era of taking down statues, Roger Taney is one of the men who recently has had his statue, I think, taken down in at least one location. And one of the reasons why is because he's the author of the Dred Scott opinion. And the court rules in that case that Dred Scott is not a citizen, that there are these fundamental differences between blacks and whites, and the founders of the United States Constitution never really regarded blacks as full citizens entitled to all that that comes with. And then for good measure, even though the court really didn't have the power to do it, they went even further and said the Missouri Compromise of 1820 was unconstitutional and never should have been passed. And in other words, really kind of lined up behind the position that Stephen Douglas and Augustus Dodge had taken in those earlier 1854 debates in Congress.
You have written an exhaustive text about the Iowa State Constitution that will come out from Oxford University Press, going through, you know, paragraph by paragraph and amendment by amendment. For historians, for lawyers, for the rest of us, why do you think this history is important? It's fascinating. But what do you think we all should know about Iowa's Constitution and how it was formed?
Yeah, that's such a good question, and it's not a question I've got an equally good or tight answer for. I guess I would, you know, when I started down this, I started down the road because Oxford Press asked me if I'd be willing to write this because they're doing a national series and they're publishing one volume on every state, and the question came to me at a good time in my life. It sounded appealing, so I decided to do it. But it's by far the writing project I have enjoyed the most. It's just really kind of sunk its claws into me. I just absolutely love it. And so my answer, I guess, is kind of a personal one. I think partly the stories of the people, my understanding of local history, parks, street names, building locations, what used to be here, what happened in this room as I walked down the street downtown, what happened right there. I know more about that. It's kind of brought the community more to life for me. The personalities are so interesting. So that's kind of one personal level of reaction. And the other is, you know, Iowa's story, I've told you a little bit about Stephen Douglas and slavery and issues of race and Dred Scott, which the Supreme Court is writing its opinion in at the very same time the delegates in Iowa are trying to predict what they're going to say. On big issues, Iowa has these connections to national history that, at least in my case, has just deepened not only my understanding of, but my appreciation for those events and, you know, what it meant. It's also changed given me kind of a deeper understanding of what it means at a given moment in time to be progressive. And to be clear, I don't take it for granted that anyone aspires to be progressive. I'm not trying to sell progressivism. But one of the things that really struck me as I was going through those old debates was how much the people at these conventions whom history judges to be the good guys, okay, the ones who by and large are coming out on the right side of some of these issues, like issues of race, mm-hmm. how much they were straddling an old world and a new world. And I'll give you one or two examples. There's a man named William Penn Clark, a tremendously influential and important figure at the 1857 convention. He was friends with John Brown. This is the same period of time that John Brown is active in Kansas. William Penn Clark is helping the Underground Railroad. He's helping John Brown's efforts to conceal fleeing slaves and get them north toward Canada. John Brown makes a trip back to Iowa in, I think it's 1859, as he's gathering weapons for Harper's Ferry. So John Brown has a lot of Iowa connections. And William Penn Clark is very much an abolitionist, so profoundly anti-slavery. But time and again at the convention, he's urging the delegates not to get themselves divided up on issues of race. And so he says, for example, on the question of voting, should black men be allowed to vote? His initial take is, why would we put that in there? It's going to alienate people. We shouldn't be dividing ourselves. There aren't that many blacks in Iowa right now anyway. You know, a few hundred of them, they haven't been clamoring for the right to vote. So what's the big pressing need? He finally comes around and says, okay, yeah, I agree. We should let them vote. And he had said on questions of public education, pretty great sounding language. They use the word Negro then. He'll say, you know, the Negro has the same kind of powerful minds that white people have. They have as much potential. They're just as smart. But on the question of voting, he says, I don't think they should have the right to vote. Mm. One of the things they did in 1857 was they decided to ask Iowans two questions. Number one, when the Constitution got sent out for ratification, this revised Constitution, one question was, should we adopt this Constitution? Number two, should we allow black men to vote? William Penn Clark made it very clear that he was glad we were asking that question, but he would be voting no on the question of black men voting.
Well, Todd Pettis, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, I'm really grateful for the time. Thank you, Charity.
Todd Pettis is a professor in the University of Iowa College of Law. He holds the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation. His book, The Iowa State Constitution, will be published by Oxford University Press next month. And he'll be sharing some of his knowledge about the Iowa Constitution and its origins at the Old Capitol in Iowa City tomorrow evening from 7 to 8:30. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. 1857 was the year the Iowa State Constitution was ratified. It was also the year that a man named Frank Brinton was born. Frank Brinton lived in Washington, Iowa, and he was a showman. He collected films and magic lantern slides from all over the world and shared them in small towns in the Midwest and in Texas. When he died, he left behind a remarkable collection of films in his basement, a treasure no one recognized until local historian Michael Zoss came across them. After he rescued them from a trip to the dump, it took him more than 30 years to get anyone else excited about them. But now this historic treasure trove of films has been shown far and wide, and Zoss himself is the subject of the new documentary, Saving Brinton. Michael Zoss is here with me now. Hello, Michael.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And producer and director of the documentary, Andrew Sherburn, is here. Also. Hello, Andrew.
Hey, good morning.
And the film Saving Brinton is about these remarkable films and the slides and this technology that, Michael, you've been able to preserve. But more importantly, the film is really about Michael. Andrew, what is it that caught your attention, the other filmmakers' attention, that made you think this is a story that we need to tell?
Well, I think we were drawn into the story right away because there was this amazing collection of films down in Washington, Iowa. And once we heard about that, we thought, we have to go take a look. How did they end up there? Why are they there? How did they survive for so long? But when we went down to Washington to make a visit to Mike's house and learn about the films, we also got to know him. And I think it wasn't very long until we realized that Mike was the real treasure down there. And so it was just, you know, we started following Mike around to all the things he does in Washington County, and anyone who's met him or anyone who knows him knows that he's a busy guy, and he is always out doing something in the community, something interesting. And his connection to his neighbors, to his community, and his love of history and his genuine ability to bring that back to life was just captivating.
And Mike, you've been trying to get people excited about these films and about the Brintons for so long. Now, of course, you know, you started to get some attention, and we talked about it on the program a couple of years ago as you were beginning to show these films and people were getting really excited about them. Then these filmmakers come along and they want to make the movie about you. How did you react to that?
Well, at first, I didn't know that they were making it about me. I actually didn't know the extent of that until I saw the completed film. And it was a little bit of a shock. They did follow me around for 4 years, and they were everywhere. But I didn't know that they had changed the focus more to a local rather than from the films.
You did.
I think he started to have some suspicions when we started, watching him put on his tie, his shirt and tie, and we were going places that were maybe not really related to the films.
Yeah, but plant my garden.
You opened yourself up you opened your home up. And, you know, people are describing you as an eccentric collector. You have a lot of stuff. You've saved a lot of things, not just this collection, but a lot of things that you feel have historical value in your home. It can be a little bit hard to move around. You opened yourself up, your home up. Do you feel like that made you vulnerable?
Oh, a little, but at that point, I still thought they were mostly interested in the films. So they took advantage of my vulnerability at that point. But they're great guys, and the whole thing developed differently than I thought it would.
At one point, there's in the film, we see you receiving an award, and Chris Rossi from Humanities Iowa is presenting the award, and he likens you to Don Quixote because you've had this dream for so long and you tried so hard to get people excited about it. And I want to play a little moment from the film where there are so many moments where this dream has come to fruition, but there's this wonderful moment where you are sharing a film that you have from this Brinton collection, a film that hasn't been seen in decades, a lost film of early filmmaker Georges Méliès. And here's historian and collector Serge Bromberg's reaction to seeing that film.
It is absolutely stunning. I need a drink. And believe me, not water.
Do you know this one?
Yes, of course. That's La Peine du Talion. It exists in color, very complete.
Do you know the actor? Is that?
It is Méliès.
It is Méliès.
If you want to see someone fainting, that's me.
I'll hold you. So you've not seen this?
Never. It's unique. It is Méliès, and that's exactly the film.
So this is a film that was preserved in that Brinton collection that people who have searched far and wide for the films of Georges Méliès had not been able to lay hands on. And there it is. How did that feel in that moment, Mike?
Well, I guess I didn't think it was that special. We'd been showing it for years at Ainsworth at the film festival. We just didn't know we had the only copy in the world. And so I did not have a background in early film, and I've been learning as we go along, but that was exciting to find out that we'd been showing something that the rest of the world hadn't seen since 1911.
And you got to go to Italy for the premiere of that film.
It was Serge Bromberg restored that film, and then it was re-premiered in 2016 at the Bologna Film Festival, and we got to show it in probably the most exciting place to show a film in the world. It was just a fabulous medieval piazza, and there were a few thousand people there, and they were just wonderful to see it. And we wouldn't have got that response in Iowa because we are not that aware of what they were actually seeing, but there it was great.
And since the film was completed, there's another film that had been lost that you found?
Yeah. So, you know, there are 130 films in the collection, and some of them are very hard to identify because they don't have a title card. We might not have a catalog that references them. But one of them was identified after we finished production as another Georges Méliès film that was lost, thought to be lost, that hasn't been seen in 110 years. And so that film, the second great discovery that was made as part of this collection, will premiere in Pordenone, Italy next week.
Oh, that's wonderful. But you won't be there for that one.
No.
So one of my other favorite things about the film, as you're showing us your collection and collections, you show us the shed where you've kept the Brinton collection for decades after you rescued it from a trip to the dump. And then you have a room in your house where that's really been set aside for this collection. But then later on, we go to the Library of Congress and we go into their film archives in this incredible controlled environment. It's amazing that this collection is preserved as beautifully as it is. I mean, you must think about that incredible stroke of luck that it didn't just fall to pieces on you.
There's just really no way of knowing what films are going to survive and which ones aren't, because one of the films in the Brinton collection at the Library of Congress is disintegrating under ideal conditions. And then we kept these in a shed in our yard, and not that we disrespected them, but cellulose nitrate film can explode at any time, and it's not something you just want to sit on your coffee table.
Right. So you had it in a shed that I'm sure gets very hot in the summer and very cold in the winter, but somehow.
Right. And the shed I've actually torn down, and that's why we had to, it was falling down, and I needed a place for the films, and that was one of the things that kind of got things going.
So, Andrew, as you're sharing this story of Mike and of the Brinton Collection, what are you hoping that people take away from seeing this film?
Well, I hope, you know, they will be drawn in the same way that we were. By this remarkable history that was found in an unexpected place, Washington, Iowa, which has an amazing cinematic history and very unexpected. But then I hope that, you know, they're drawn in by those films, but then they get to know Mike and they get to know Iowa, and they understand the community and the culture that we have here in small town Iowa that I think they'll be surprised at. I think there's a lot of depth and a lot of richness and vibrancy down in Washington. And, you know, that's something I think we think that, you know, New York or L.A., that's where all the culture is made in this country. But there's a lot right here in Iowa. And I think that people all over the country need to see that.
So the film premiered in Washington, Iowa last month, and it's been showing. It showed in Ames. It's been showing in Iowa City at mm-hmm. Film Scene. And it's going to be there for another week, right?
Yeah, we're there have been such great crowds that we're holding over for another week in Iowa City. It's great.
That's wonderful. And other appearances, you can find them at savingbrinton.com. You're also going to be taking it on the film festival circuit, right?
Yeah. Actually, our world premiere was at the AFI Docs Festival, okay. The American Film Institute, out in Washington, D.C., and the reception there was outstanding. Two sold-out shows. Mike was, you know, the star out there. He had his he had Frank Britton's hand crank projector, and people were kind of swarming around to see him hand crank 100-year-old films on this amazing machine. So that was really fun, and audiences responded there, which was kind of our first test outside of Iowa. How will people react? But I think they loved seeing this part of the country and getting to know Mike as much as people here will.
Well, I was going to ask you, how have audiences been reacting? What have people been saying to you about the film?
Well, I think, you know, as we showed it in Iowa in particular, people are, you know, I think their hearts are bursting with, you know, pride, because I don't think Iowa is shown in this light quite so often, or the Midwest in general. You know, I think we're often thought of as flyover country or something like that, and that nothing interesting happens here. So to see this sort of thing is great. I think it's a source of pride. And that's really wonderful, because Mike's a humble guy, and we're Iowans. We're all kind of humble. But I think, you know, sometimes we need to stand a little bit taller and take pride in what we have here.
Well, you have some incredibly beautiful shots of the landscape, of the scenery, although the film starts in the dead of winter. And I thought, ugh. That's
it's coming again. I know winter is coming.
That's not going to get people to want to visit. But having shown it, having premiered it in Washington, D.C., and knowing that this will show outside of the state of Iowa, what is your hope for those audiences? Because obviously people in Iowa are going to take a lot of pride and a lot of ownership of this story, even though most of us didn't have any contact mm-hmm. along the way. What do you think that audiences outside of Iowa are going to see in this?
Well, I do hope they see Iowa in a different light, and I think they get to know Iowa in a different kind of way. But then I think just more broadly, I hope people, you know, it's the message of the film is actually to appreciate the place where you are, no matter where that is, and appreciate the history and the community and the people that you're surrounded by, and really to engage with your community, which I think is an important message, especially right now, where we need to reach out and connect.
And we all have stories. But sometimes we ignore them. When we were in Washington, D.C., a lady said, "And this happened in Iowa?" And we said, "You know, we didn't get that question in Iowa."
In the film, there are many moments when you give your wife some credit for her patience with you. This collection moved into your home the first week of your marriage?
Yes. It was probably very good that it was the week after rather than the week before.
So for 30 years, this collection took up a huge amount of space,
a whole room. And more
in your home. And you worked so hard for so long to try to get the word out about it. What was the watershed moment where you felt like, oh, finally, someone cares?
It started slowly, but what really got it going was when Tim Johnson from Humanities Iowa saw the films at a convention that I was showing them at. And then he started saying, "Here, there's more here than what anybody realizes." And that kind of got it going. And about the same time, I was working with Special Collections at the university about an ultimate location for the collection. So several things kind of came together. And suddenly, something that we'd taken for granted became a big deal.
And now it's gone beyond, I would guess, your wildest dreams.
Oh, indeed. Indeed.
So are there other collections in your home, Mike, that you're trying to get attention for? Is there another story here?
I didn't think I was trying to necessarily get attention for this one, but I just wanted more people to appreciate
right.
it. And I have a couple other collections, probably.
So what else is hidden there?
Oh, I'd have to hunt and see.
Well, there is a plant that shows up a couple of times in the film. Many people who know about Grant Wood, they know about his portrait of his mother holding a plant, woman with plant. You actually have the plant, not a plant like the plant, but you have the plant. How did you get your hands on that?
I was able to get it from a man here in Iowa City who had gotten it from Mrs. Armstrong in Cedar Rapids, and Grant Wood had given the plant to her. And there are other people that have starts from that plant. It keeps multiplying. But that plant is in Woman with Plant. But if you look, it's also on the porch in American Gothic, the same plant. So it's just fun. I like, when I was teaching, I always like to have kids see the real things. Not pictures of the real things, but, you know, if we were talking about the Civil War, I would have Civil War letters for them to work with. I just think if you start people with the real things when they're in junior high, then there's suddenly an appreciation, and we just need to give more credit to kids of the ability to understand things.
Well, and even though you're retired as a teacher, you're still teaching. And that was wonderful to see in the film. So many moments of you connecting with kids and introducing them to these objects that if you saw them, you wouldn't know what they were. But you were actually splitting wood and cutting shingles in front of a classroom. So you're bringing history to life for so many people.
Well, we teach history backwards. If we started teaching local history to kids, they could get excited about history someplace else. But if we start with Egypt, it's hard for them to identify with that. So I always like to teach students what happened in their backyard, and then they can identify and broaden that out.
Well, Mike, you've certainly kept a lot of history alive. I think, Andrew, you could do another documentary with Mike.
Well, we've got 250 hours. Maybe we got to go back and
recut it.
See what else is there.
So, all right, the film is showing right now at Film Scene in Iowa City. Again, there are showings listed at savingbrinton.com. You're heading out on the festival circuit, and a lot more people are going to see this film.
That's right. Yeah,
it's exciting.
We're excited.
Congratulations to both of you and to everybody involved with the film.
Thank you.
Michael Zoss is the subject of the new film, Saving Brinton, and Andrew Sherburn is producer and director of the documentary. Again, you can find out more information at savingbrinton.com. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.